So beginning our first day of the first full day of the retreat, one of the things maybe that I'd like to talk about this morning is maybe how to hold the retreat or how to view it. One of the differences of a monastic retreat, or hopefully is different anyway, is the emphasis on the maybe like many different aspects of the Buddha's teachings and practice. The monastic lifestyle is that it's a lifestyle for those who are living in a monastery. The practice becomes very much part of the daily routine. And practice over a long period of time. So the emphasis is not so much on a particular technique or just on a meditation methodology, but it's hopefully a way of using the teachings and the practice in many different circumstances and over a continuity of time. There's a teaching that Ajahn Chah gave many, many years ago. It was just a phrase that he used, and we ended up translating the talk that he gave, and that phrase became the title of the talk. And it was right practice, steady practice, sort of. In the sense of, there's oftentimes so many questions about, you know, what's the right practice? How can I really get it right? How can I get the right method that I know I'm not going to be wrong? But Ajahn Chah, his approach and his emphasis was, well, really what the right practice is steadiness. And just a steady continuity of practice, a steady application of practice, a steady commitment to practice. So that is an approach that is a basis of the training at a monastery, and particularly within Ajahn Chah's tradition. Of course, it's also hopefully an example for people to be able to lay community to take into their lives. And I think it's very important to recognize that, again, sort of what is right practice is not some really special, only applicable in the rarefied realm of a monastic environment. Of course, for anybody who's actually visited the monastery and lived in any monastery, you realize that it's actually not much of a rarefied realm. It's ordinary people trying to do something good with their lives. And that sense of learning how to use the different circumstances and aspects of our daily life. These 10 days are an opportunity for learning how to apply that, from just learning how to get up in the morning. Well, that's pretty simple. You know, learn that sense of, okay, when it's time to get up, to join in the morning puja, that setting the mind, setting an intention, following through on an intention. Ajahn Sumedho used to use a phrase for encouraging people to begin their practice in the morning, and sort of leaping up with alacrity. You know, which isn't what most people associate with waking up in the morning. So that it's really trying to bring that sense of alacrity and clarity and kind of a verve to the beginning of the day. Because oftentimes how we begin the day starts to set things in motion for how we will apply ourselves during the day, so that sense of taking that opportunity. And you realize that, of course, it's not just in the morning, but these are how we get this, bring this steadiness to practice. We can always start new, we can start afresh, we can begin again, and then that application of a clarity and alacrity, bringing a certain interest to the day, to the practice. And then as we carry on through the day, these are that you realize that it's not, practice isn't just the formal sitting meditation when we finally get our mindfulness onto the object of meditation, but our meditation is learning how to apply the mind to whatever circumstance we're engaging in. And of course, when we learn how to do that, learning how to apply the mind, applying attention in the different circumstances that we're in, when it comes to the meditation is much smoother, much more meaningful. And that's where Sayadaw Ajahn Chah's encouragement is, both in terms of using the word meditation, but in its broadest sense of training oneself in applying attention, applying our mindfulness and awareness. And where Ajahn Chah says, you feel like meditating, and you meditate. And you don't feel like meditating, then you meditate. that's the sense of training. So that during these 10 days, it's an opportunity to experiment with that. And of course, one of the aspects for monastics is that having given ourselves to training and to a a form, one keeps returning to that sense of giving oneself to the practice, so that this is an attitude that we can be cultivating in these 10 days, and it's an attitude that you'll find will serve you well in daily life. It'll serve you well in continuing one's practice in whatever circumstances that you find yourself. Because it isn't as if monastics are continually inspired and energetic. It's just that we live with one of the things that the benefits of living in a monastery is that it's rare that we're all miserable and dispirited at the same time. So that it gives a chance for the group to support each other. And it's recognizing that, the mind changes. Sometimes there's faith and inspiration. Sometimes there's doubt and uncertainty. And sometimes there's energy and sometimes there's laziness. Overall, there's just a returning to practice, returning to training, returning to the willingness to be attentive, be aware. Because once we give up that quality, then we're in trouble. It's the that developing that awareness. The awareness muscle, I guess. Mm-hmm. Putting that to good use. Some of the, we're using the form, like with the chanting, morning chanting, evening chanting. This is an opportunity to bring forth an effort in reciting the recollections of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, recollection of teachings. And as we do that, they tend to reverberate in our hearts, and that's a good thing, considering the range of things that tend to sort of roll around in our minds. It's a good input to be these positive associations of the teachings of the Triple Gem. And I think with the group of people that we have here, it's like a gathering of old friends, sort of friends of the Sangha, coming together to practice together in a group and forming a community. And that's it's an opportunity to share our interest and commitment. So that as we do things like the chanting and devotional practices, we were talking at breakfast and just sort of saying, it sounds like oftentimes in previous retreats, there's the chanting sort of begins a bit meek and at the beginning of the retreat, and as people pick up more fluency and confidence, then it becomes stronger and more voluble. But people, right from last night and this morning, people seem to be right on the case. That's great. It's wonderful. But it's also important to recognize that we, again, using these are tools for practice, so that the chanting is both an opportunity to put effort into the recollections and verbalizing it, chanting it, but then also a mindfulness practice of attuning oneself to the rhythm, the cadence, the tone, the pitch whoever's leading the chanting, and then paying attention. A lot of the focal point of chanting is not so much the verbalization or vocalization of the phrases, but chanting is done through listening, so that both learning how to listen to the people around one, so that one's tuning in, but then also listening to the, because there's an inner listening of the what the phrases are pointing to. So listening is a is an important part of chanting, and it's not usually it's not immediately obvious, but that how much that listening plays a role, and of course, listening takes mindfulness, so it's already a training. There's elements of traditional practice that just in the sense of say having a shrine at the front that it can form a focal point for our observation and attention, because it just having the traditional aspects of the say the, that we have flowers, incense, candles. These are traditional offerings to the shrine, offerings to the Buddha, and I appreciate that people brought flowers and did a nice job on the. On the shrine, because it makes the shrine a worthy focal point for, say, uplifting attention. There's something very naturally beautiful about flowers, and then when they are put in the context of an offering of a devotional offering to the Buddha, to the shrine, then it takes on, say, a very positive meaning. So these are aspects of practice that sometimes slip by us, I think particularly as Westerners, the devotional aspect, the aspects of faith. Even though Buddhism is a, and particularly the, say, the Theravada, the more kind of ancient strata of the teachings, are quite straightforward, quite coming back to the fundamentals. But still, there's a. You think that that aspect of devotion has sustained people's faith and interest in the teachings and in the ability to apply the teachings. On a certain level, there's our intellects and rational evaluation of the teachings only take us so far, and we do need to tap into a root of confidence and devotion that isn't really based on words. So this is, say, the meditation and the training is hopefully also being directed in that direction, are directed in that focus at times also. So that as we say, we have a period of time that we're practicing together to be able to explore these different aspects of the Buddha's teachings. Sometimes if we're focused on a methodology, like a particular meditation technique and just keep sort of pushing away at this technique, sometimes it has good effect, but I think for everybody here, most people here already have a strong commitment to practice over a long period of time already. So to be able to explore these different ways that we can be expressing our practice, and of course learning from that. So this is, I think, a flavor of a monastic retreat that is important to be attentive to. And it's certainly what, say, as those of us who have been in the robes for longer periods of time, I think of myself, I'm at 39 years as a monastic. It's sort of... and what is really, to me, what and on a certain level, it's sort of like, wow, where'd the time go? It's just gone so quickly. But the teachings of the Buddha are such that I still find myself really interested in the teachings, and still in awe of the Buddha's insight and wisdom. It is something that is extremely humbling. And I think that's where these aspects of devotion have the opportunity to give us an expression of that sense of humility and respect towards the kind of commitment of the Buddha. There's a after the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha's reflecting internally, sort of articulating, and sort of think. And his first impulse is I don't know if I should bother to teach this. It's just the propensity for human beings to be hindered by ignorance, obstructed by craving. Mm-hmm. These are that's sort of an idiom. And the Buddha is saying, it's not easy to be able to disentangle oneself from that vortex of ignorance and craving. And that the Buddha was able to do that, and then also to give himself to teaching. He was enlightened at the age of 35. He kept on teaching till he was 80. That's an amazing contribution to the to the humanity, opening the opening the doors to the deathless. And it's not a small thing. And the our opportunity is to be able to take these teachings and to be able to apply them. And certainly for us at this time, I think the extraordinarily fortunate, just the ability to access the teachings. There's both the sort of the printed version, translations of the suttas, translations of the teachings, and then translations of ancient commentaries, the contemplations of contemporary teachers are available in print, in audio, in video. There's so much available, and then the access to the teachings is actually quite widespread and fairly easy. So very fortunate. We're extremely fortunate to live at a time when there's a stability of both economy and the social, political realm. In Buddhist history, that's gone through many, many upheavals and times of extreme difficulty, but at this particular period of time is one that is, in general, even though one can find all sorts of flaws and drawbacks in the social web of things, but comparatively in human history, this is quite stable. And it's actually the Buddha talks about, there's discourses that he gives of sort of exhorting the community to practice, because he's saying, there will be times when there'll be famine, and it'll be difficult to practice. It'll be difficult to apply oneself to the teachings. So there will be times when there'll be war and social disruption. And it's difficult to practice in those circumstances. So that at this particular time, we're fortunate to live in quite comfortable circumstances. Here we are sitting in the Angela Center, and this is pretty cushy, pretty comfortable. So that to use the circumstances to one's advantage, to recognize that, and to delight in that. The habit of the mind is and it easily drifts to the what is difficult, or what one's lacking, or what is not as ideal as one would like. But in terms of practicing for freedom from suffering, one realizes that this is good enough. In fact, better than good enough. And to just not getting caught up in the mind that tends to discontent. And whether it's discontent with the external realm or whether it's discontent with oneself, because we, you know, if our attention isn't being taken up by the dissatisfaction of the things around us, then we just tend to not finding a decent enough focal point, and we'll just turn it on ourselves, and it's, you know, it's easy enough to find our flaws and our drawbacks, but to that phrase of, you know, this is good enough for practice, this is good enough to understand the true nature of things, and that's all we need to do. We don't need a perfection. In fact, you know, good luck if that's what you're waiting for. we do have the opportunity to be mindful. We do have the opportunity to recognize that the fundamental nature of mind is to know. And being able to know and to be aware, that's enough for liberation. That's enough for freedom. To be able to return to that quality of knowing. And this is, a teaching that comes through comes through very strongly in the Thai forest tradition. Being the one who knows. That's one of the most common translations of the word Buddha. Buddha is the one who knows, and it's not that it's sort of that the Buddha knows something special. The Buddha is able to fully dwell in that quality of knowing and awareness, and that is the opportunity that we all have. When Ajahn Chah went to pay respects to Ajahn Mun and to receive guidance in his practice, because he was at a point of having a lot of doubts and uncertainty as to his direction in practice. And what Ajahn Mun told him to do in his practice was to just pay attention to the difference between the mind and the objects of mind, in the sense that paying attention to the quality of knowing and seeing, and then the objects of mind are more like the moods, the thoughts, all of that, the movement of mind, that's what's arising and ceasing, and inevitably keeps returning to a place of dissatisfaction, discontent. But embedded in that, is the ability to know that. And when we return to the knowing, then we have a refuge. When we're entangled in the objects of mind, in the proliferations of mind, the movement of mind, the moods of the mind, then we're entangled in the world of arising and ceasing. We're entangled in the world of birth and death. And there is no refuge in that. There's no end to that. But when we're, and it's not a big shift, but it's huge. When we return to the knowing and gain a sense of trust in the knowing, a sense of confidence, and a certain skill in that we've by doing it over and over again, we begin to realize that it's not far away from us. It's not distant. It's not something that and it's not even something that we have to make or contrive. It's what's there already. So that returning to the knowing, being the knowing, another way that Ajahn Chah expressed it was in terms of progressions or trajectories of practice. First, you have to know the Dhamma. Then you see the Dhamma. Then you have to be the Dhamma, and it's sort of being the knowing. Is the quality we keep returning to. So that as we go about our daily activities, chanting, following the routine, engaging in the formal meditation practice, helping with the chores. Everybody has a chore, a duty, and using those as the opportunity for developing that mindfulness and returning to the knowing, even when we're engaged in some kind of activity. It's not impossible. And because the habit of mind that we easily pick up is the I can't wait to get back to practice after my work is done, after my chores are done. But that's a wrong assumption of our capability. It's learning how to both use the different chores or activities as a opportunity for supporting, because it's in terms of dana and giving. We say that the retreat works when everybody gives to it. A community functions well, or a family functions well, a society functions well, when we give to it, when we're able to apply that sense of a generosity of heart. And that same generosity of heart is what allows us to apply ourselves to mindfulness, to awareness. If we begrudge something during the day, it's hard to bring an open-heartedness to the to something as basic as the breath. It's actually a very simple equation. The more one is able to apply a generosity of spirit, a spirit of giving to the circumstances around one, that's what we give to our meditation object. And when we give to the meditation object, then it becomes interesting. The meditation becomes something that is not a chore. It's not a task. It's not a duty. Something that is interesting and satisfying. So that on a, this is a flavor to explore of how the teachings and the practice are so intimately woven together. There isn't really anything that's out of place. As Ajahn Chah used to say that, you know, in the same way that wherever you pick up the teachings, all the rest of the teachings are going to be there. It's like I've got a shawl beside me, and if I just pick up a little thread here, the whole thing comes up. It's just is quite natural. And the same with the teachings. We pick it up from some aspect, but all the rest of it is there. So that learning how to recognize that and apply oneself to it. So that as we take this, this 10-day retreat, framing it in a way that we can really learn from this, and just go beyond there's a tendency of it just being for the meditation, but the meditation is a part. It's actually interesting that Ajahn Chah was considered a great meditation master, but in listening to his teachings and over a long period of time, the vast majority of his teachings were actually not about meditation. They're about sila and samaditti, so virtue and right view, because these were the foundations that actually that's what ties everything else together. So that bringing the practice back to these fundamental virtues, and then what is the right view that allows me to not suffer. What is the view that complicates things? But then what is view in accordance with truth? So that virtue and right view should underlie all of our, whether we're engaging in activity, whether we're trying to apply ourselves to a meditation object, that's the ground that we rise up from. Offer that for reflection this morning. And we can maybe just sit for a short period of time. And we'll have a period of walking meditation. The meal will be at 11 o'clock. But if people find, anybody finds that walking meditation is more conducive to your practice, you want to do more walking meditation, that's fine. If you want to do more sitting meditation, that's fine. I will run a certain routine and have it in these periods of sitting and walking. But I don't want people to feel that they're locked into that, if it's not working for you, then to experiment with either more sitting, more walking, as one wishes. The main thing is going in and out of the hall to be as quiet as possible and not to disturb others. Another thing that I thought of, which might be nice, I don't think I've done it the last couple of years of my leading the retreat, but particularly as this is, I mean, it's always been, Thanksgiving retreat is always a kind of almost like a family, big family gathering, the aspect of traditional practices and devotional aspects it might be nice to like before that at 8:30 and then at 1:30 there'll be a teaching, if there could be a formal request for a Dhamma talk, and I don't know, maybe Itesi, if we have maybe a roster or some way of deciding who. Hmm? Yeah, that'd be great. And for those people who've never done it before, it's an opportunity to learn. It's also a great way just to sort of learn the basics of pronunciation of the chanting. But it's also a nice way, both in terms of a formal request for teachings, but also another, when there's a formal request, then whoever's giving the reflection begins with we'll do a paying homage to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, so that it brings in a traditional and devotional element that I think is helpful. So, anyway, we can sit for a bit.